Live from the International Debate Research Center, Love Livable, Jamaica, Queens, New York City. This is In the Bend, your number one source for news and views on debate, argumentation, rhetoric, all that good stuff. Dr. Steve Yano here with you once again. Welcome back. You know, you can email us anytime, any comments, questions, thoughts. Always email us inthebendpodcast@gmail.com. But also, since the podcast is now hosted by Spotify, you can go to Spotify and actually leave us audio comments. That's right. If you go to the Spotify site for the podcast, which I think, actually, I probably should have pulled it up here. Actually, pretty easy to get to. But, you know, long ago, this show used to be hosted by Anchor FM. Long ago. But I think that, I think now you just go to Spotify.com and search for In the Bend. Send us a voice message. You can even leave us a tip. Not just a verbal tip. You can leave us a monetary tip. And that money will go right directly into my pocket. No, not really. It'll actually go into the show and make the production of the show better. Better mics, better stuff, and eventually video. So check it out. Consider supporting the show. You can do it through the In the Bend website on Spotify, which is podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/in the bend. It's probably easier just to go to podcast.spotify.com and search. I bet that's the easiest way. But however you're listening to us, we're happy to have you here. This episode, very special episode, years in the making, is an interview with Wake Forest legend Dr. Alan Loudon. He agreed to talk to me recently, and we had a long-ranging interview, hopefully the first of many, of the history of debate, NDT and CETA, American policy debate, and some of the challenges that debate programs and debating in the United States faces. Hey everybody, Dr. Steve Yano in the bin here with an interview that I have been literally waiting years to do. I'm very excited about this interview. I don't know how long we've been working on it, making it happen, but his people, my people, the negotiations are complete. The NDAs have been signed. Everything is good, and now we're going to talk for a while with Dr. Alan Loudon, who's a professor emeritus, communication department, Wake Forest University, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I hope I have all that right. My Carolina geography always gets confused. And he was director of debate there. Or I guess it was director of forensics was your title.
For 30 director years. Director of debate, actually. Yep. Uh-huh.
Director of debate. I think that's a better title myself. That was my title when I was doing debate stuff. For 30 years, and so he's seen it all. And we're just so happy to have you here, Al. This is going to be great. And Al and I share a mutual interest in debate history. Mm-hmm. And that's what we talked about. When was the last time we saw each other in person? I was trying to think about this before.
I think it was in Lewiston, Maine.
Lewiston, Maine.
At a funeral.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the last time we had a really nice dinner downtown. That was my first and only time there, and what a neat town.
Yeah. This is in Burlington, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, Burlington. That's right. Yeah,
I said Lewiston, but I meant Burlington.
You know, that that conversation was a memorable one for me. You gave me a lot of wisdom that night.
Cool.
A lot of things to think about. That was a great chat. And
I recall eating well.
Yeah, I think we had great food. I don't remember the restaurant we went to, but it must have been maybe Amber Jack's on Church Street there in Burlington.
Yeah, I was on the main street. And that's first, like I said, the only time I've ever been there. And that was really a treat.
Yeah.
Because I've known about it forever and ever through Snyder and others and daughter and all that. And so it was a real nice to go.
Do you recall when you first met Tuna Snyder?
I don't. And he is so memorable. How would you not recall?
Yeah.
Tuna was a little bit larger than life. My guess is my first impression was, who in the hell is this guy? And he's bouncing off the walls.
Yeah. And I had a similar first impression.
Later learned more and more. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
He became a friend, and he would come down, and his daughter is married to Wake's debate coach, Justin Green.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And so we got to know each other better in our older age, and he would come and sit in the deck, and we would visit. It was great.
That is great. That sounds great. Yeah, I had a similar impression of, like, when you first meet Tuna, he kind of expands you know, kind of like Doctor Who, like a Time Lord, kind of expands into your past and into your future. Yeah. You're not quite sure when the moment was you first met him.
Yep.
Yeah. So speaking of Wake, I'm dying to ask you this first big question is, you know, we're debate historians, but we're sitting at a moment of debate history. You and I were Wake, Forest won both the CETA and the NDT championship in the same year. It's only ever happened one time before. What are your thoughts on that? What were your feelings about that? Oh, I lost your audio. I don't know if it's the headset.
But I wasn't getting the sound through here from you, so that's why. Oh,
okay. No, that's okay. That microphone sounds great, though.
They won the ADA and the CETA and the NDT.
Oh, ADA is ADA too,
which has never happened, as far as I know. And you mentioned that you just said somebody else had won it twice, won both in the same year, and I don't recall that happening.
Yeah, is it Emporia State?
Oh, that's correct. You're right.
Yeah.
Of course,
it was a while ago.
The big guys. I remember him. Of course, he was here.
Yep.
As a grad student.
Yeah. So as a longtime debate coach, what was your feelings when you heard that, when you first learned about it? How'd you feel about that?
I was actually there.
Oh, you saw the debate?
Yeah, I got to go up and introduce the honorary alumni person that year, and Jared was kind enough to include me, and it was like a movie. The thing just kept unfolding, and there was some momentum. You could feel it happening. And by the middle of the Elim day, felt like there was an inevitability that I hadn't seen before. It was the most amazing thing. Mm. And good fun. And of course, it doesn't mean a hell of a lot in one level. These things are pretty ephemeral, but for the kids involved and for the alumni, I think as much as anything, that these things matter. And they, of course, give your program a little standing so they can't get rid of you that soon.
Yeah, that makes it a little more difficult. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Everything's political.
Yeah. Boy, yeah, that's true. Do you think there's much, the differences between CETA and NDT, there's not much of a difference today, would you say?
Well, there's no difference today, essentially, although it's a little bit. You get a little bit different people at the two tournaments, slightly. But that's a residue as much as anything, I think. And I noticed this year there were teams at the NDT that have never been there before. You get UC Davis or another school that had never been there before, and I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, to their credit, they were different, but I don't know if they were so different debate-wise. We always acted like they were, that one was more research-oriented and the other more value topics for a while and that kind of thing. They were culturally different because they were big school, small school thing. The same kind of thing had happened with the honorary societies in earlier years with DSR, TKA, and Pi Kappa Delta, et cetera. It's the same kind of differential between the haves and have-nots, if you will, of the debate world. And what happens in debate, and there's so many debate organizations, because I was president of the American Forensic Association, and I dug that up pretty, all of them and all their officers, and got them all talking to each other for a little while. But they're basically people will find a level of the activity they can support in which they have some modicum of success. And then that's where they go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty good analysis. You dug all those people up and got them talking to each other.
I did.
You're like the United Nations.
4 years when I was president, or 2 years I was president, whatever. And vice president. That was fun. I don't think that's kind of hard to do. You're just finding these groups, or there's so many different small debate groups, as you know, and then you get in the individual events, because the AFA, of course, did that as well. So you had to go there, and that's another whole levels of competition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other way of the cultural difference is kind of along the line of qualifier, more elite versus more of a, I guess you'd call it a populist debate. In the sense, and that's kind of what they came to represent. Now, Jack Howe's version was, we have cross-section, you guys don't get it. And of course, he was somewhat of an enabler of his own construction. So in that sense, he kind of kept it tight and kept you know, it's easier to have an enemy than it is to have a mutual friend who's doing something similar in any kind of competition.
Yeah, it's so interesting,
You get these kind of faults, if you will, competitions between the two things.
Yeah.
Now, when they merged, the merger was not the first merger. I don't know if you have any know that at all, but the first merger was NDT said, this is stupid, and we adopted the CETA topic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And CETA said no, and they changed their topic. We adopted it again. And they said no, and they changed it again. And we finally said, okay, guess we're not merging. And that was clear back in probably the early 80s, or late 70s, actually.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't come to pass until Ross Smith, because Ross was as bigger than life as Tuna was in many regards. Oh,
yeah, for sure.
And Ross just sort of willed it. But the difference then was the organizations were ready. Mm-hmm. NDT had gotten too inbred, even though it maintained the numbers, but it was fewer schools, which is sort of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And CETA had gotten to where they were starting to worry about membership somewhat. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense to people to merge it. And you also had the Michigan States and the other sort of higher end schools in terms of competition in CETA who kind of wanted to give it a shot.
Right. Yeah.
States and people like that.
Yeah. Do you think the motivating factor, because you're putting the first merger in the early 80s, I hadn't really thought of it that way before, but as somebody who lived through it, you'd have a better perspective than me. When you read the discourse out there, it seems like, you know, there has to be this detente, this big sort of agreement, this conversation between the two of them. Do you think it was the leadership, like the faculty, urging that on, or do you think it was the team saying, I want to see what these CETA kids have got? I want to debate these CETA kids. I want to see if they're as good as I heard.
I don't recall the NDT people saying we want to debate the CETA people, because that would have, you know, exposed some notion of not being able to maintain their notion the other group's inferior.
Right, right.
I don't remember that conversation on the NDT side. Their motivation was, we're getting too small, we need to bring some people in. Mm-hmm. On the CETA part, I think that was there. And now you say, was it coming from the students or coming from the coaches? It's always a combination. Mm. It's always a dialogue, a negotiation, et cetera. My guess is the students wanted to give it a shot as much as anything. And then some coaches were more ambitious than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard some people from the time when there was the crossover being like, oh, we heard those CETA people were fast. Let's see how fast they are. Like, yeah, we heard they could really spread. I'm
sure there were comments like that. I don't remember that specific one.
Yeah.
But that would not surprise me. Or we'll see, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's some competition out there that's halfway decent that you haven't tried. Debaters are debaters, man. They want to go for it.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to see that with NPDA, or if we're seeing that with NPDA. Well, I think that's a bigger wall.
That's interesting. I don't know enough about what's happened with NPD, with the parliamentary, Western parliamentary, I think of it as, and I don't know how you
think
exactly
of it. Right. No, that's exactly right.
But that's exactly the old CETA schools, you know, or mm-hmm. the schools that were, didn't have the money to keep playing in NDT, which was a lot of them. And I don't know what's happened there. I just not geographically available. And of course, I've been retired long enough now mm-hmm. that I make up things. So if that's happening, that would not surprise me, because I'm guessing that post-pandemic parliamentary has some membership problems, and they want more people, and their schools have shrunk, as just like everybody else would be, I guess. Uh-huh. So I could see where they could see, well, this, why not merge?
Yeah, I don't know if it's happening either. NPDA is what I did in college. I went to Texas A&M, and there was a lot of sediment that was in the early 90s. There was a lot of like bad blood feelings among the faculty about CETA as being something a little bit not educational, not good. They had canceled their CETA program. Yeah, but NPDA looked clean to them in some weird way. We were able to go to NPDA tournaments. But if you mentioned
the difference is marginal.
Right.
At best. And it's prejudicial for all kinds of reasons. Now, why the faculty would have decided one was uneducational and the other was educational sounds like an old debate we have in the profession between elocution and invention, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
It's the same kind of debate, is that we're doing the good stuff and those people are out of it.
That's the, so old, that the
kind
old debate.
That thing doesn't, that's that kind of commentary, particularly when you're leaving something, doesn't surprise me. Now, you're at Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. That's pretty competitive kids. These are pretty high-end kids. I guess you were lobbying your coach to try NDT.
Well, we were not permitted. You know, we had a yeah. Guy with a master's degree, John Tyndall, brilliant guy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But he was not. He wasn't tenured. He wasn't. You know, he was kind of at the bequest of people like Marty Medhurst and.
Yeah, well, that
people like that, and they were kind of anti-debate. Yeah, they were kind of anti-debate. But there was one person on the faculty who advocated for us who was of a high caliber, and that was Jim Onney. Mm-hmm. And Jim Onney said, we do need a debate program at this communication department. And he was the person who got us the money. We went and did NPDA, but my partner, Mark Floyd, and myself, we were old policy guys. And so we would just try. It was very funny because I remember being in many rounds where I'm trying to explain my argument. And finally, I just get so frustrated. I'm like, basically, I'm just saying they don't have any inherency. And then the judges all just vigorously nod with a smile on their face and write it down. Because it's something familiar, you know? So when we talk about mergers, it also might be more archaeology than anything else, like reinventing the wheel, dusting off these old institutions.
Absolutely. We're actually, the arguments, that's my guess, is you made a lot of the same arguments you would as an NDT debater. You just changed the language for their container.
Yeah, I just never said no link.
Yeah.
You know, I said it a lot, but I didn't say it.
Plan inclusive counterplans or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you did it functionally.
That's right.
And even when we debated, when I back in the Stone Age, which we were just coming into the era of fast speed, et cetera, mm-hmm. because there was some advantage in that. And of course, you always take every advantage, and that's not abnormal. Even then, we were, a lot of the arguments are very similar to the ones now. We had different names for them. But the essential argument was similar.
Is there an old theory argument or argument you used to run that you kind of miss, you wish, you think has some value and that debaters ought to dig up and dust off, like a PMA or PMN or justification arguments or anything like that?
Well, the one they shouldn't dust off is hypothesis testing.
Oh.
Because that's so impossible to ever evaluate in any sense in that particular kind of context. So I'd let that one go. And with all due respect to Zarefsky.
Right. There was a time, though, I bet you can remember when most of your judges were hypotesters. Or claimed to be.
Well, they claimed to be, but then that held up, 7 to 8 years maybe? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But not much more than that. There was a time in the 1930s when counterplans were the rage.
Mm. Yeah.
And that would include inclusive counterplans.
And these debates are cusp
these
of...
These are just when tournaments start.
Yeah, right, yeah. This is way on back when. The cusp of the tournament as opposed to the Pentangular League, Triangular League. I wonder what audiences
they probably
would have
thought. They probably were in tournaments like speech associations and conventions and stuff. And I'm probably predating it when I said the 30s. I really talking about the late 90s and early 40s, maybe.
Right. No, I think that's when tournaments kind of take
there
off.
There are arguments on counterplans why we shouldn't have them and how it's destroying debate. And you'll get QJS things on that kind of stuff. You've probably seen that kind of thing.
Yeah. William Holly Davis in 1918 is like, look, I went to a debate competition, and there was a counterplan, and it was perfectly normal. It's what would have happened at a city council meeting. Why are people upset about this? This is what happens in our democratic institutions.
Yep, they have to get used to it. Have to get used to stuff, I guess.
Yeah, and he's like, well, you know, he's like, it mirrors what we do in our democracy. Why would you not want students to do that? And he was just kind of baffled by the...
Well, that's a pretty good argument in those days, because debate, a lot of the reason debate did well was partly because of the invention of the speech departments coming out of English.
Yeah.
And then there was a place, and then it wasn't that expensive in those days. Another reason they did it, and particularly in the 40s and 50s coming out of the war and before the war, is to promote democracy. Mm-hmm. Democracy promotion, which is not, it's a topic, argumentative container that would be very useful right now in this day and age, but hasn't been used by anybody because there's no spokesman anymore for debate.
Right.
I can see, not really, not on a national level. But that would be an available argument. Very similar. We need debate because we got to teach kids how to be have a democratic society and how to argue in that format, which is exactly what that counterplan thinks is. This is how we legislate. Come on, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, there was a period when there were national congresses and other kinds of debate forums that weren't debate tournaments, but they were like a legislature, state or regional or even national, and they would have speakers of the House and they would do bills and everything, but they debated and they were populated by debaters.
Yeah, this is like Congress or Boy State, Girl State,
these kind of events. Yeah, well, there's that thing, that too, which is a similar notion, but no, there were actual oratorical contests, oratories and things like that. And then they also had a congressional, like a legislature. They would meet like the legislature and do bills and debate them. And all the schools in the state would take part.
That's so cool.
And Wake and Duke and Trinity or Davidson and State and all the schools did that for, probably 10, 15 years. In addition to the tournament, this is when tournaments are coming in and intercollegiate's fading.
Why do you think it was? Now I was about to make a joke and be like, wow, somebody should really write a book on all this stuff. But that's what you've been doing, right?
Well, yeah, within the lens of the Wake Forest perspective, but of course it's always a reflection of the national perspective.
Right.
And I do that with some intentionality, yeah.
So what do you think it was about at that time? Why did the tournament dominate over all these other forms of competition? Why was the tournament so attractive to people?
A number of reasons. First of all, the intercollegiate debate was getting spent because it comes out of a tradition of the Lyceum movement and people going to no other entertainment. You wouldn't listen to speeches. And so these debates would have big crowds. The community would come like you might go to the movie. And they were often on serious topics about community things. Well, sports and other meetings and other clubs and transportation. And Raleigh got a hell of a lot closer when people had a car than when they had a buggy. And all those kind of things conspired, and multiple student groups and the literary part of literary societies, the magazines and kids that wanted to write and become famous because they were too cool. All those kind of kids, all these things competed.
Right.
And it's just like now, is the debate going to survive the internet and all the competition of crap out there? There's so much stuff we can't get through a day without hundreds of inputs, right?
That's right.
All competing for our attention. Well, this is like we're on hyperspeed of what they were going through in a social sense. Mm-hmm. So that's why it goes away and the audiences quit showing up. Mm-hmm. So you had a debate and you had a big debate with Colgate or something like that in say the late 1930s. Well, that's a big deal because that's the famous Northern Baptist school. Mm-hmm. You don't get anybody there. Basically, yeah. Even though it's a big event. So they quit doing more of those and it becomes more like, well, we're having a public debate. We invite people across campus. That's kind of what it is now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what it became. But that was because the competition of the social, of the world, how the world is. Mm-hmm. And we're in a period of that now. And I don't know how debate will survive. I just don't know what form it's going to be. I kind of doubt it's going to be tournaments. Now, tournaments happened because they were cheaper and easier and the coach was going to the convention anyway.
Right, right.
And they sort of happened serendipitously. I don't know that they intended, but we could debate four or five times instead of once.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Think about it from the kids' point of view. That's much more exciting to travel somewhere and actually compete.
That's right. Yeah.
And so the really smart kids didn't want to wait for 6 months to do a public debate. They wanted to go get on the road.
Yeah.
And They would get on the road. They'd go to the PICAP Nationals or something. One of the first ones with the old jalopy car in 16, something like that. I don't know. Maybe a little later now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had to be later now. 20s. But just having a car was amazing. They went 3,000 miles. They stopped and debated everybody along the way. Anybody that had a home to go to get fed, they went. They didn't sleep. They went to Oklahoma, or they went to Kansas City or whatever for these tournaments once a year for the end of the year. So that was much more exciting than having another public debate that's soon forgotten. How's that for answer?
That sounds great. That's great. You know, it reminds me of John Meany at Claremont Colleges. He calls this format barnstorming debate. Because everything needs a format. So barnstorming debate, you go across the country, you debate every school between here and where you're going.
Well, that used to be real stock, actually, in the end of the intercollegiate era, the tours.
Yeah, that's right.
So like Pittsburgh was the most famous probably, and they would hit like 20, 30 schools on a tour.
Yeah, I've seen some of that archival material. I did my PhD at Pittsburgh. They have some of that
archival. Oh, have you been to that? Oh, I'd love
to see that. Archival material that Gordon Mitchell had up in the squad room. But it was like hand-drawn sort of itineraries and maps of where the train's going to go and where they're going to go. No. And there's some photos, too.
So they must have library stuff, too, because they have a really rich history.
Yeah, they've got a ton of archival material there. So you ought to give Gordon a call. See if you can get your hands on some of that stuff. Be great.
I ought to get Gordon organized. Give me a break. I'm smarter than that.
Well, then maybe you ought to just go talk to the archivist.
Gordon's a lovely person. He was a TA here back when.
Oh, wow. Yeah, back in the day.
Back in the day.
Yeah. I was going to go back to something you said that got me thinking, which you said there's no spokesman for debate.
Well, I wonder what you mean.
I wonder what you mean by that, because when you said that, it made me think, well, there's plenty of spokespeople for debate, but they don't use the word debate. They say, we need more dialogue. We need more discussion.
Well, but those people aren't talking about what we're talking about.
I mean,
they're talking about discussion versus debate. And those people are, in my opinion, no offense, insipid.
Right.
We're going to sit around like in a humanities thing and talk about how awful it is in humanities for the rest of our life as it goes away.
Right. Yeah.
Debaters would be more activists than that. Mm-hmm. And debate is more activist in terms of what it does to you, mind, body, and soul.
Yeah.
But I think the people are saying, oh, we need more democracy. There's a lot of that.
Yeah, that's true too.
Institutes at every damn school now, mm-hmm. spending millions of dollars to bring in speakers to talk about things they agree on.
That's right.
And I don't know that that's good. I don't see that as a spokesman for competitive debate.
Right. Okay.
And I don't know how you become that or who it is or anything. It's almost got to be a leadership thing by schools of being the debate school or whatever other people recognize. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like the NDT schools aren't equipped to do that. The NPDA schools aren't equipped to do that. I wonder. So one idea I'll float to you.
Maybe no school is. Hell, they can't even do it on the Palestine question. Come on.
Oh, that's true. And NCA is no help, you know.
NCA doesn't have a clue.
Right. They absolutely. Do you feel like NCA is anti-debate?
I don't think. I think they're. I'm anti-what?
Anti-debate.
No. I mean, they don't know what they're.
They don't even know what they're for. Means. Yeah. NCA. What does that stand for?
Many people have.
Yeah.
I think the fellow at Maryland, even when he was still there, was sympathetic.
Yep.
Other people I don't even know, so I don't know.
Right.
But they're not coming out of a debate culture, mm-hmm. which in the old days everybody did, but that's a different world.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the senior members, the distinguished scholars of NCA have a brush with debate or some debate training, but they don't want to admit it. They don't want to bring it up. They don't want to promote it, and that really mystifies me.
Makes you wonder where they were.
Exactly. Exactly. And it makes you wonder, like, why would you be embarrassed of that tradition? I feel like they're embarrassed, but that's my opinion.
Oh, I think they don't want to get involved because it would cost money and be tricky.
But there was a time when NCA was very debateful. So, for example, Jack Howe. You're talking about Jack Howe.
Yeah.
I found in my research a speech he gave to the SCA. And mm-hmm. it blows my mind to think that the SCA would be attentive to hear a debate coach talk about why he's creating a new format. For more than 2 minutes in the hallway. But he gave, you know, they gave him time at the convention to deliver this long address where he sort of outlines in a very nice way. This would have been in 72, I think, outlines in a nice way the distinctions between what was called Southwestern cross-examination debate and NDT.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know where the convention was?
I don't. I can look it up though real quick.
Just curious because may have been there. It's possible. I was just starting the career, like the first or second year, so might have been there. But debate still held enough sway within NCAA, particularly among the leadership, that that kind of thing could happen.
That's wild to me. Because yep. Now it's like, you know, use the word insipid. You know, you think about what NCAA spends its time on. I think that's a great, great word that comes to mind.
Well, that's kind of an unfortunate word. I don't want to be held accountable to that.
No, word. I'll take ownership of that. It's beautiful.
Yeah, because I
don't get mad at Al. Get mad at me, listener. Send me the hate mail. I love it.
Yeah, because I don't really know. That's the thing. Obviously I know when Star was running it a couple of years ago and things yeah. like that, but it's got other political issues going on, and it doesn't worry about these kinds of small things. Not just debate, it's all kinds of areas.
Right.
That feel cut out. And of course they got so many areas now because that's how you build constituency, which isn't a bad thing. Uh-huh. That is a very different organization. Hello.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And the AFA used to be able to do it, but once they gave up the rulemaking ability of tournament rules, it didn't matter. It was really important for many years because all the coaches, that's where you debated out the rules, like the NDT committee.
Oh, yeah.
Was AFA. And so AFA was big, and it was a co-convention with NCAA for a long time, fairly sizable one. And then when they changed that, so they went to the NDT and the NIET committees to make those decisions on tournament procedure, it dissipated largely. Huh.
That's except so interesting.
The journals still maintain good, but, you know.
Yeah.
Now journals are in trouble, so who knows?
Right. Well, JAFA, which is now Argumentation and Advocacy, JAFA used to be a forum that, like, now that you've said that, when I look at old JAFA, sometimes I'm perplexed by why these articles are an issue together, but it could have been an agenda-setting kind of function for the national meeting where they want a rule change or they want a change in policy.
Oh, well.
So they write an essay to kind of like maybe prime the membership to start thinking in ways about the philosophy of judging. I mean, it's mostly about judge paradigms.
It is mostly about judging like it always is. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is, yeah. But that's the history of debate, as you well know, from 1916. It starts with the question of judging.
Oh, yeah.
And judge rules. And the Triangular Absolutely. Leagues had the same problem, too. That
everybody.
Yeah, which is so funny to me.
Wake starts with its first intercollegiate debates, 1897.
Yeah, that's early.
And it's pretty early in the process, actually. And it goes for 5 years. And it's with another school. And each school, they hadn't thought it through. It gets the time when they did their contracts. They were kind of contracts, as you know. Mm-hmm. And they had five judges for each one selected by the home team. And the home team won every year. So Wake won the first year, and then the second year, Trinity won. And they were held in Raleigh on Thanksgiving as a part of the huge day, and they would fill the Opera House with overflow crowds and everything, right? Because the kids came in by train. It was pretty amazing. Well, the other school loses the fifth one, so they lose the trophy.
Oh, wow.
And they're kind of pissy about it, and they stop a year early and decide they're not going to debate, but they don't tell Wake. So Wake gets kind of mad about that. And then it becomes a big newspaper debate for a long time about who is responsible and who the bad guy is, right? When Trinity College pulls out. Now, all this makes sense once you realize that Trinity becomes Duke.
Ah.
Then the fact that they do this kind of thing makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a bad Wake joke on Duke. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. That's great. That's very funny. Still waters run deep, but I guess they're not so still the closer you are to the river.
No. And Duke was really a player for a long time, and then they lost their coach, and your English moved into esoteric world and self-destructed and all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, the history of debate and the history of English departments at the Ivies is tight. Until after the Civil War, then you get the intercollegiate. Then they start to bring in the economics professors and others to teach classes for the debaters about here's how to argue economics, which actually doesn't sound like a bad way to organize the core curriculum as a whole.
No, not at
all. It's like, let's make arguments and let's have the students make arguments, participate in debates on things like the value of literature, psychology, economics, anything, anthropology, whatever. Whatever you want in your core curriculum, you know? And if you want to teach language, have them do it in French or whatever. They used to do it in Latin.
There's no faster. It's like immersion in language. There's no faster way to get a kid to start researching, get interested, and start understanding and say you're debating it.
Yeah. Has Wake hosted a lot of these international debate tours? That's a big part of American debate
history. We used to. We haven't of recent. And the CIDA, I don't know who runs CID now.
NCA is trying to kill it again, you know.
Huh?
NCA is trying to kill it again.
Well, they tried before.
Yeah.
Unsuccessfully. When I was actually running it, I think they tried it.
Oh, man. When I was on it, they tried it. I think they try it every few years and they think there's no memory left.
So they're always going after something that might cost them a dime.
Why? Why are they doing that? It's baffling to me.
It could be. I don't know why. The generous thing would be something like, well, it costs some money and they don't think it's worth it because it's so few people, or that they're worried about liability questions or something like that. That might be a generous construction.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly the ignorance of what they do and not much communication between the committee and them and no celebration of it.
Right.
You got to
right.
celebrate these damn things to sustain them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. Yeah, I did that when I was running the British tour. We used one of our slots to have a reception for all the hosts and the debaters, everyone who could come. We had food. I think that's what you do, is you make it a part of the convention that people look forward to.
Sure,
not a debate in like Salon J at the Overflow Sheraton. It's got to be part of the center of the conference.
When Bob Branum, before Bob Branum passed debates, of course he was one of the players in that. He was a really, really good guy.
I wish I had been able to meet that guy. He sounds amazing.
But I went to the 50th anniversary of the first British debate, which they hosted.
Wow.
So it went to Bates College, and that was pretty fun. Now, we hosted them a lot, and I hosted, like, the Russians several times even.
Mm.
And I was chair eventually, finally. Not that I wanted it. I mean, just sort of, you know, how life goes.
Well, it's jury duty. We all have to kind of do our democratic service.
Yeah, and I enjoyed
service.
It. But I invented that Eastern European tours, which we did the Baltics and the Balkans and et cetera. It didn't sustain.
Right.
But it went for four or five tours.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty
and
good.
And I thought that was a really good place because Soros was putting money in there and every mm-hmm. country had debate. They still do.
Yeah, that's right.
But CID probably doesn't even know that exists. Maybe it's possible.
Yeah, there was always a talk of redoing the Eastern European thing. But, you know, since Viktor Orban in Hungary kicked the Central European University out of Hungary. It's in Vienna now. The Soros money has kind of dried up. An IDEA, which used to have offices, you know, the International Debate Education Association, used to have offices everywhere. I think the only one that's left is Amsterdam.
Really?
Yeah, they've all kind of closed up because there's just no money left because these right-wing people have taken on, you know, this kind of attack where they're like, okay, this Jewish liberal is funding debate. It sounds very insidious to them, and people kind of get behind that.
And they're supposed to be the democracy people, huh?
Yeah, well, supposedly, but it's like, you know, they're the ones who often conceal ideology on the guise of debate all the time.
If anybody's listening, I think there's still debate in Estonia and Latvia, Lithuania, that would be sustainable for tours.
Yeah. I think Estonia would be a great one.
It was marvelous. We got to spend 10 days. That was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I know Denmark has some stuff too. It'd be good to do a Baltic one. Could do Sweden. Yeah,
there's
Sweden, Finland, Denmark.
That would be way, way fun.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool too. Yeah, where do we get the money for all this?
I don't know. Basically, it's usually self-sustaining.
Yeah.
In that the hosts, you know, pay for the local transportation, you know, place to stay, mm-hmm. feed them. Mm-hmm. And usually a fee of some sort.
Yeah.
And they use that as promotion. And you could do it that way. It was never NCA money.
Right. Maybe we don't need a spokesman. Maybe we don't need a spokes school. Maybe we just need really attractive events to American audiences.
Well, of course.
That would be the way to promote it because you could do, I'm thinking about the Irish Times tour, which I don't know if you had any experience with the Irish debaters. That was NPDA ran that for a long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then as NPDA got more technical, they didn't want to have the Irish debate because the people who win the Irish Times, they don't necessarily participate in their debate team. They might just be good speakers. One time I hosted them and they were three three medical students who had never been to a debate tournament in their life. So when they went to one, they were like, whoa, it was like a whole new, it was like pulling back the curtain on a secret room in their house, you know. They were blown away, but they were amazing speakers and amazing arguers without one lick of debate training. I think that's so unique. And so NPDA moved away from that as they got more technical and they started, you know, perming the counterplan and all that stuff. The Irish Times debate wasn't a part of their agenda. So,
I think maybe the,
it was taken over by, Brent Northup up at Carroll College. Okay. And he created a nonprofit group to run the Irish tour, but the Irish Times is behind it. They got, you know, newspapers, whatever you say, newspapers failing. Irish Times has some money and, you know, they promote a really good
somebody
event.
Somebody has, having a sponsor like that, like the Language Babble group in Japan was huge.
Yeah, that is.
I know Brent because I taught a semester there when in the governor's campaign, I was up there working with my friend.
Nice.
In Montana. So I know him and you don't get much more Irish than that.
Yeah. You're Montana. You're a Montanan yourself, aren't you?
I am.
Born and raised in Montana?
You bet.
And did you debate in high school in Montana?
I did.
Yeah. Tell me about that experience.
Well, I think it was a little bit more persuasion than argument.
Who's judging these things?
They were high school coaches. Same thing.
Parents, other teachers, people's parents, grandma.
Well, there was a little more of that, a little more like the public forum, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But that was the only forum. So I guess public forum was by definition public forum and everything else.
Yeah. I think public forum is such a funny name.
But it was the NSDA gave it. Yeah, it was cross-ex and everything. And it was just sort of stock debate, if you will.
Right. Stock issues, you know, you're just like.
Yeah, and every school had programs, so that was huge. Right. Tournaments were huge.
Yeah.
Because all the schools had debate in those days up there. They didn't get to go out of state. They wouldn't let us do that.
Right. But you didn't need to.
Well, you didn't.
It would have been fun.
To get competition.
Oh.
And I think Kansas doing the half a year.
That's right.
Where they can't travel, didn't used to be able to travel extensively, produced a healthier debate and produced lots of kids who became coaches and other kinds of participants in debate. The other thing you ask, how do you save this? I don't know, but I think if you could get schools to start adopting it as curriculum or as methods within particular curriculums for teaching, that then that would get a momentum of its own that might have some shot because there would be a bigger public. There would be many people experiencing it. It would be across discipline. There would be lots of reasons. And then out of that would grow. Somebody wants to compete. So I'll always get tournaments out of these things eventually.
Yeah.
Because of human nature.
Yeah. But we see that anyway. Like for example, essay competitions. We teach the essay in English courses. And then there's an essay competition. It's healthy relationship. You have the Writing Center. I think the Writing Center is a great model for the future of debate. Where you have a place on campus, people come to work. Sure. Hey, I'm trying to convince my friends that let me help you build an argument. But then you've also got your competitive debaters in there doing tournaments. You've got your public debate. But I always thought public forum was such a funny naming because it just kind of reveals that there's private there's private forum debate, which would be like policy
it
debate,
does suggest
LD.
That,
it kind of suggests, no,
they needed this, a name, I guess.
There's this debate that's not for you, and it's private forum, invitational.
But public forum debate's sort of like debate, probably the days I did it. It's really reminiscent of that kind of deal.
Yeah. I mean, they're going faster now and they're starting to incorporate. I last saw my last high school public forum a couple of years ago here in New York City. Urban Debate League here. Which is the New York City Urban Debate League is fantastic. I don't know how they do everything they do, but I get all their emails. It's Stephen Burchard is running it. He's a serious dude. But
Stefan also is another former assistant coach here.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that's why I bring him up. I want you to promote Wake. He's very good.
he's doing all that AI stuff.
It's incredible.
Everything. He's out of control.
He's a good machine. I just think of him as a machine. He's like promoting AI debate now. So I'm like, I was right to call him a machine.
Got a book out. No, he's doing all kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I last saw him. It's been quite a while. We had lunch in D.C. a long time ago. It's been 4 years now, I think.
Yeah.
But we're still in touch.
That's great. How many debate rounds have you judged, do you think?
Oh, God. Not as many as some people, because it's sort of like grading. I didn't like it very much.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
Because I never knew exactly where justice lied, you know?
Right.
So it has that sort of downside of grading. And I don't know, hundreds, obviously, in some years we went to like, 15, 20 tournaments individually and judged all of them.
That's right.
Kind of thing. So there were a lot, but other years I judged less and less later because I could find other ways of getting out of it. And,
right. That's the dream of every coach.
Yeah. And I just, there are rounds that are still in my head after all these years, which was like a 3-2 or a 2-1 at the NDT or something. And I'm on the top of it, totally uncertain I did the right thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. That's my follow-up that you got to. What's a debate that still pops in your head? Or as the kids today would say, it lives rent-free in your head. That's what the kids would say.
I almost don't remember the participants now. I just remember a couple of NDT debates where the debate got beyond me and I did not know. I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
That happens sometimes.
It does, yeah.
Particularly in the hearing thing. And, of course, they think that everybody, they all seem to know what they're doing. And the other two judges act like they know. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't. So,
yeah.
And I think I probably voted wrong a couple of times and I still remember those. Remember it was round four. I remember things like that. They stick with you. But at the same time, what happens in debate is that sometimes you win rounds that you shouldn't. And later in your career and early on, you lose rounds you shouldn't. So I guess on balance, justice is done.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And it's still a persuasion event.
Yeah.
I always go back to that somehow each team had an option of presenting differently than they did, so I would have gotten it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they chose to do something else, which is fine. So I only feel partially complicit. But judging's tough.
Yeah. I've only done a fraction of what you've done, but still some pop in my head. And to the surprise of nobody listening who was judged by me, I got it wrong a lot.
Yeah, well,
I think the best backhanded compliment I ever got from a debate student, and this was not told to me, it was overheard by someone talking about me, is like, man, he was his RFD was so convincing, and he got it so wrong. So speaking of it as a persuasive event, sometimes I feel like the judges are the people being evaluated, the students are doing the coaching, and then the judges are supposed to make the right decision, and it seems very backwards to me.
There's a lot of that, and judges, just like professors, get better across time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because you know more, you integrate more, you're not quite stuck to stuff.
Right.
And just individual arguments that were in the debate, and that's how you justify it. You kind of got a bigger picture, all those kind of things. I think judges get better for a number of years if they keep judging.
Is there an NDT or topic that you thought was like your favorite or the best one where you were like, oh, the debate didn't get any better than that topic. That was such a good, rich topic.
There was a couple fun ones. One was on the government should regulate land use.
Okay, that's about as vague as it gets.
It doesn't get much bigger than that. Everything's sort of attached to it, right? And the affirmative won everything. That was not a good topic.
No.
I think my favorites were the presidential power.
Yeah.
Expansions of presidential power, either foreign policy or domestic, depending. Yeah. Both those kind of forms where I thought were.
That's a pretty recent topic, really too. Good. Unless it was done before in another format. Sometimes they kind of come around in an edited form, but I think the presidential power is one did not have that history.
Yeah, it had two or three versions, I think, across all my years.
Mm-hmm.
And each was fascinating. And, of course, all the questions about how power works or under the not directly talked about much, but they're there.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah. That's a good one.
And of course there's all kinds of good affirmatives and negative.
Right,
I like the ground on those topics as well.
Yeah. We participated in a CETA sponsored event at the FDR museum on that topic.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of like long table debate.
Yeah.
Format. It was pretty nice. Pretty nice event. They did, up there in New Hyde Park.
Yeah.
I was here at St. John's. We're not too far from the FDR library.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing, a way in which debate's not going to go away, because there's the prison programs and all the other kinds of things that are happening. There's a need for this kind of intersection of argument, and always has been in society, I think, unless you've got a total dictatorship.
Right, right.
So I guess in some ways it will, I'm not sure what its form will be, but it's not going to go away per se.
Yeah. I wish there was, no, I don't think it'll go away either. I just wish there was a way. Do you think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but my opinion is I wish there was a way that we had better assessment of the connection between these formal debates, formal structured debate, and the ability of citizens to engage.
Oh, I think there's there's some pretty good research on that. I think Winkler's and a whole bunch of people's things, particularly on the Urban Debate League. But even before that, there's substantial research that says that's the case, that the product is functionally different mm-hmm. than a normal student experience, mm-hmm. and the feedback is not even close. Now, that argument could be made of all kinds of groups people become commit to and actually do something with, where they get into it, they have some ownership. Then that could be true of a number of things, even sports sometimes.
Right, yeah.
But, of course, that's got so crazy now and regulated by the coach. It's just a disaster, whatever.
Yeah. It's almost like it would be better to have the intramural sports.
Well,
than the professional intercollegiate sports, and I often wonder about that with debate too.
That sort of goes back to the non-sustainability of discussion versus debate.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? I mean, you got a kind of soft form that's more palatable, but it's too soft in terms of the instruction that you would like.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not trying to argue with you, but you see what I'm saying.
No, I absolutely agree, because the thing that's dominating talk about, every debate coach listening and every debater listening is going to know, we'd love to go to that, but we don't have the money. But then you have these big universities putting millions into things like intergroup dialogue, which is a theory that, I mean, what is behind that? Virtually nothing.
Bullshit.
Yeah, well, they have a book, and they have a couple of advocates who've written a book. Yeah. One has a law degree. And then they go and charge thousands of dollars to give a talk about intergroup dialogue. Yeah. And then you hire a director for intergroup dialogue, and you're like... Why is that so attractive over...
We have programs on campus that the president puts out routinely, like Let's Talk. They have names like that.
Right, yeah.
They put up posters and they hire some people to do that shit. Yeah. And then people go have a discussion and realize there's other people in the world. That's kind of nice. I have no problem, but you could probably do that and go into a class.
Sure.
But
with who we're pulling for undergraduate these days, every class is going to be diverse like that. It's up to the professor to open that up.
You're
going to have people from all kinds of backgrounds in that room, and whether or not you open it up.
They're spending millions on that because it's a showpiece.
That's right.
And it protects their butt in terms of criticism.
I think it's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. There's nothing to say, well, that's bad that you have people talk. It's just not nearly the same thing as having people learn.
Right.
And actually have command of material and capacity. That's a very functionally different thing. And that's what debate does.
Yeah.
But you get bruised and it costs money and all the kinds of things. And it is a little exclusive and all the kinds of things that go with intense training.
Yeah, do you think all this stuff about wokeness on campus and the inability of people to have political conversation, is this going to help or hurt debate in the way we like to talk about debate on the American college campus? Is this an opportunity for debate to promote itself,
Absolutely,
or is this a threat?
It's an opportunity. We have a way of getting beyond that to where people appreciate both sides, actually think about it and debate them and actually encounter the arguments. And this other accusing each other of wokeness or of basically the competition to shut down voice
right.
or free speech is astounding in the moment on both sides.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think it's a huge opportunity. Yeah, we have a product to offer that counters this. Go look at Urban Debate League and a few other things if you don't believe me.
Yeah, right. I think it's just four are
happening with those kids because of the intensity of this experience, and you don't want to do that. Come on.
Yeah. Well, Melissa Wade used to always say, these kids move the needle. She repeated that all the time.
They do, and Carol Winkler and others have, subsequent to her too, a bunch of research now. It's pretty damn good.
Yeah, the Urban Debate research is great.
These administrators who are just covering their ass, I don't mean that meanly because I think they mean well. It's sort of like, 1970s, go to the California coast, kumbaya in a hot tub.
Yeah.
it's kind of pleasant. And I don't see why you wouldn't choose it sometimes.
Sure.
But it's not what debate does.
That's right.
It's not the gritty toughness that you get out of debate.
Yeah. You need the yin and the yang. The yin and the yang. That's the way I think about it. I'm not opposed to having a dialogue session, but you also need to have campus debates that don't solve the issue, but whet the appetite for more of that kind of discourse. Because it's process. It's process. That's
like
what we want to
do.
Any
other thing, every time you have a course and somebody says, let's get rid of a course for a better one, they always say, oh, but this course could be so good. Mm-hmm. This course is good. It has value. And they're not wrong. Compared to what? It's always a comparative process, and that's what's not assessed.
You're absolutely right.
What's assessed is how we've done it, and I know it has value. And I go, well, yeah, you're right, but not compared to getting a bunch of classes that are actually good.
You're right.
Anyway, it's that kind of comparison.
Right. Well, we're coming close to the end of time. You've been very generous, but I want to ask you one final really hard question to kind of wrap up the thing.
Sure.
Describe to me what you think intercollegiate debate is going to look like 20 years from now.
Oh, God.
What do you think is going to be preserved? What do you think is going to be way different and new and adapted? What weird thing that debate coaches are like, no, I don't want to do that, is going to be just standard practice? What would you say? Like, look into your crystal ball. I mean, it might be more like the Johnny Carson routine where he holds the envelope up.
Yeah, well, that's an impossible question because I don't think we can predict 5 years out anymore. Things change so damn fast.
That's true.
And of course, you're always wrong when you make these predictions. Mm-hmm. Having said that, one thing that concerns me, one way to solve this, of course, is have debate online and go in a social network and things. But I'm not sure that's sustainable because humans are social animals, and you got to be with people. And you get these lifelong friends when you travel, and you build a community that has afterlife. College doesn't, except for the damn reunion. You know, a few people you know, but it doesn't really have an afterlife.
Right.
But debate does. And the Ben Franklin or State Department grant did, and things where the kids actually are intense with each other for a sustained period of time. I think human nature demands that. And absent that, you can go to a couple online tournaments, but it's really hard to keep the kids. There's too many other things that are equally accessible and interesting. I can go play computer games. Hell.
Right.
I do.
No, me too. That's what I'm doing after this. How'd you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to watch the
yeah, you're going to watch the basketball.
Game,
yeah.
Watch the NCAA game.
Hell yeah. But
having said that, I suspect we will see debate in pods of different interest groups initially, and then they will join up over time. There'll become some cool ones and some not cool ones, and ones will grow and some will fade. So I think that the essential evolution that's been true in this country ever since debate started will happen again in smaller communities, and that will join up. That would be my prediction.
That's funny. Yeah. Steve Johnson, who's the coach at Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah.
He was on the podcast years ago, and he made an argument in that interview for strong regionalism. And he's like, that's the heart of what has always made debate good, strong regionalism. They want to connect once in a while.
If you're in Anchorage, what else do you got to go to? You better before that. We traveled to Arizona with the Anchorage kids once when I was a coach at the community college in Wyoming. So we did. That was a long damn trip.
I bet.
In two vans without gas tanks. Remember the days?
Oof.
Before, you don't remember the gas shortage in Clinton. You're too young.
No, I am too young for that.
On Carter. Anyway.
Give me the plates with the odd numbers because you know you can gas up at the tournament.
But he's not wrong in the sense that if regions are strong, then they lead to strong national.
Right. I think that's what Johnson was arguing. Yeah.
Yeah. But boy, they're hard to sustain because you got to have tournaments and you got to have people to go to them. Mm-hmm. And the constraints on programs have to do with inadequate coaching often, but not always, funding, competition, COVID fallout, schools retraction, less students, smaller colleges can't afford anything. The real small ones, you know, they're trying right. to survive. So I think all those things conspire against regionalism.
Right. No, I think you're right. I think that's a really good argument for that. It makes me think the move away from the tenure track PhD coach to the master's coach is like more important than we make it out to be.
It's dangerous in the sense that you become you become disassociated.
Right. You get kind of an NCAA coach rather than a, you don't have the scholar coach. You have this kind of NCAA minded coach.
Yeah. The ones that with PhD people tend to be programs that are internally stronger, at least because they have an advocate.
Right.
But not always.
Right.
Kind of depends who the person is, doesn't it?
No, it's true. I think the quality of the coaching changes as well.
Yeah,
you get somebody more pedagogically minded beyond the tournament.
Yeah, yeah, and there are people who see it as a bigger picture, and people who are just beginners are just trying to say, "I'm okay, I can win some, I'm cool," and that's fine too. That's a stage. I get that.
Yep.
And that you need that kind of energy too to sustain. So it's an interesting. There's so many trade-offs. I think if we had curricular pressure from a more general faculty and we celebrated it in some way, like the films they did out of the national debate tournaments that group did in the public debates, those were really good. They were compelling, actually. Mm-hmm. Some things like that.
Where are those films today? I'd love to get a hold of them.
They're hard to find. I can get one of them online. The rest, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I wish they would digitize those. They're sitting in a dusty shelf in an archive somewhere.
Yeah, there were about five of them, and they were really quite good.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
Those kinds of things have to bring you to a public consciousness. Now, the Great Debaters did its part, but that's ephemeral.
Right, right.
And it helped some schools. It helped that school particularly.
Oh, yeah,
so
for sure.
You have to break through, and that's a tricky damn thing to do. Now, that can be done at all kinds of levels, within the university, within the department even, within regional associations, within NCAA and stuff. But that's a matter of kind of luck on personality, who's got the guts to do it.
Yeah.
Or the drive. So anyway, it's a tricky thing.
Yeah.
And that even that might not be enough, given the society being so diverse, spread out, too much competition for our attention.
Yeah.
Writing a book's tough because there's so many other damn things to do.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. I feel it all. I feel the tears. Yeah. It feels like people tearing at your brain all day.
Yeah.
No, come over here, do this.
Now, I'd be kind of curious your response. I mean, obviously, some of the kind of things I'm saying today are in there, implicitly at least. They're not directly in there all the time. It's close to where I will have essentially the final copy. I'll share it with you.
Oh, I can't wait to dig into that. You're an excellent scholar, excellent thinker, excellent writer. Everybody who's heard this interview will agree with me. So I can't wait to tear into that. Maybe we can talk about the specifics of that. And are you going to write, this is the first of how many volumes, do you think?
There are three volumes, and number three is already done because it's called Milestones, and it's the compilation of lists of various kinds. Mm-hmm. Like all the topics they debated in the sessions and those kind of things, which is horrendous to get, man.
Yeah, I know. Well, Jack Howe had these collections. I see it cited in the National Forensic Review. I think a rule, looking at the National Forensic Review from the 80s, I think a rule was you had to have at least one, maybe two, unpublished Jack Howe manuscripts cited in your essay. And they were things like, they had titles like, List of Intercollegiate Winners from da-da-da-da-da. Like, Jack Howe was just kind of like a human archive of this stuff. And I assume these papers are still in Long Beach. I have the archivists trying to help me, but
there were whole books. There were whole books put out in the early 70s that recorded the results of every tournament in the country.
That's crazy to me.
I don't know how they did it.
I have a couple of these National Textbook Company CETA Final Round transcripts.
Yeah.
And they remind me, you know, those Norton books from the 30s, 40s, 50s of all the, you know, there's a stenographer sitting in 1938 writing down everything they're saying in this debate in a gym somewhere. Yep. And these are fascinating.
Oh, yeah. And of course, there were books, you know, 1930s and earlier that were compilation of debates.
Yeah. And debaters today don't recognize that they're living in a history that will be interesting in the future. They don't want to be recorded. Yeah. They don't want it to be recorded. They don't want their speeches recorded. They don't want to be filmed. But they're really kind of creating a dark age for
the
pedagogy of argument. Listen. You know, people are going to want to look at, and they're going to say, well, in 20 in the early part of the 21st century, how was argument being taught at the university? And they're not going to have any archival material.
I was shocked. Answer to your first question, the first book is written. The third one has been revised. Right. And the second one we're starting on.
Great. That sounds great to me. I can't wait.
The second one's a modern 1930 on. The last year at Nationals, I was quite surprised when our teams, our very own teams from my school, debating other minority students, kicked us out of the round. We were not allowed to listen.
Wow. Wow.
It happened two or three times, and I thought, well, that's pretty wild.
And that was a sincere, or is this part of an argument strategy? Or
well, I think they didn't want people to hear what they were saying because it would be used against them, as their argument is how they would be used against them racially. Mm-hmm. Because they were kind of mixing it up among the race. Yeah. So they didn't want anybody to hear it.
Right.
I get that in a sense.
Me too. Me too.
But your statement that we're doing a self-imposed censorship that isn't preserving history, that's part of that. Mm-hmm. So I was curious. That's a dilemma that I don't know how you get it, what your response might be.
my response is say, look, let's look at the work of Angela Ray, for example, where you have these black literary societies who recorded everything, including the names of the debaters and the arguments and the vote. Yeah. And they kept all that as part of their organization. Sure. And that was in a time when, you know, you still had an apartheid state. I guess you could argue we still have an apartheid state, but not a structural.
Everybody did that. They were all the societies were the same. I did research down at the one in Atlanta and Howard and other places in their archives. I've been in those archives for their history of the triangle debates and all those kind of things. And so, yeah, that was normal to record what happened, every debate in your ledger, so your society and stuff. That was normal for everybody.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so.
But I agree, your students debating other minority, I mean, there is a history of this. You know, the discourse will change if there's one white person in the room. You know, you think about second wave feminism, where you have courses for women only, men are not allowed to. Like Mary Daly at Boston College comes to mind as having a women's theology class that no man could take, and people sort of threatening a lawsuit on that, because it is true. You know, you and I are communication scholars. It's kind of true that the discourse changes based on the presence of a body,
of course,
of an identity in the room.
They're not wrong, and there might be a value in trying different experiments and exclusions, but a discourse built on exclusion for your own enhancement seems to me unsustainable.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. I agree.
Anyway, it's been fun.
Yeah, Dr. Al Loudon, thank you so much. I can't wait to have you on again. I hope you'll want to come back.
Well, it's fun. It's good. Fun. I thought I didn't have anything to talk about.
Oh, no. This is where I prove everyone wrong who comes on the show.
Yeah, and I thought, well, we could have gone for a while.
Yeah, we certainly could, but I'm not going to keep you from making snacks and getting ready to watch that game.
Yeah, we're going to watch the game in an hour.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks so much.